When I used to walk with Madame Halevy, she always said the same thing. "That old spider?" Rachel said, her mouth pursing with distaste. Camille grinned at her response. When he did, he so resembled his father that Rachel felt her love for him rise up inside her. More, not less. "I'll be able to return the favor to Justine for sewing my new jacket," Camille said joyfully. Now that he knew his fate was his own, he was filled with good cheer. "I'll bring the dress she made for Lydie to Paris." "There's no need," his mother told him. Soon she would be in the gardens of the Tuileries, where she would astound strangers when she told them about the turtles that arose from the sea on a single night, and the blood-red flowers that had been planted by the wives of the pirates, and the flights of stairs built to protect runaway slaves from the werewolves that chased after them. She had begun to pack that morning, making certain to leave room in the crate for Camille's paintings. She patted her son's arm to assure him she was ready for what came next. "Justine and I can bring the dress. We'll already be there when you arrive."
Chapter 11. The Season of Rain. Charlotte Amalia St. Thomas, Paris, France, 1855. Rachel Palmier Petit Pizarro. There was trouble brewing in America, a lawlessness that sometimes portends war. Our business was failing due to the unreliable shipping trade, particularly along the coast of South Carolina, where piracy was not only indulged, but it seemed encouraged. Frederick had made a promise to the ghost of my first husband to watch over his holdings, and therefore would not leave until this promise was fulfilled. I could see he was torn. He had approved my plan to finally go to France. My daughter Delphine was seriously ill in Paris, and my son Camille would soon be going there to study. There was no longer any reason for me to stay. Frederick knew my heart's desire had always been to leave this island. He wished to accompany me, but he was too good a man to shirk his responsibilities. Once the business was more settled, both my son and my husband would follow me to France. Mr. Enrique would then be the manager of the store, overseeing day-to-day dealings. A third of our income would belong to him, the rest would be directed to Isaac's family. We might have paid Mr. Enrique less, but we owed him our lives. Had he not carried my father to the harbor in a wicker basket, I would never have come into this world, and my children would never have been born. There would have been no woman to greet Frederic when he arrived in St. Thomas, and no one to pay the herb man to save him from his fever. As the time for my departure grew near, my husband and I were both seized with nerves. In more than 30 years, we had never spent one night apart. After all this time, he was still in love with me, and each time I saw him, I felt the same pulse in my throat that I'd had when I gazed out the window and saw him surrounded by bees. Frederick was 53, still so handsome that women in the market nudged each other when they spied him. I knew what they were thinking when they saw us together, for I was not remarkable in any way. What does he see in her? What spell has she used to enslave him for a lifetime? If they wanted to think I was a witch, I didn't mind. Perhaps I was one. Perhaps I had called him to me, ensuring that he'd had no choice but to fall in love with me when he saw me in my white slip. It was the one morning I didn't pin up my dark hair. I had chosen to stand there, half unclothed, even when I saw the desire in his eyes. On my last day in St. Thomas, I went back to the house where I'd grown up. As I walked through the gate, my skin pricked with sadness. I expected to feel the same turmoil I'd always experienced when I thought of the sort of daughter I'd been, never good enough. But there were only spirits of the past here now, jittery, fading things that sparked through the tangle of vines. If the new owner spied me, they didn't chase me away. They closed the shutters and left me in peace. Perhaps they'd heard rumors about me, or it was possible they saw me open my hands so that the last stirrings of those who had lived here could gather, drawn to the heat of my flesh before they scattered into dust. I had imagined I would be distraught when I returned to the pathways of this garden. Instead, I felt a surprising tenderness for the landscape of my childhood. Despite the marriage of convenience my father had made for me, he had always loved me. He'd respected my intelligence and taught me the business. Because of this, I'd always had a high opinion of myself despite what others thought. True, I was arrogant, but perhaps that is not the worst trait for a woman to have. I knelt down to peer beneath the hedges for the lizard that had been my cousin's pet, for such creatures are said to live longer than most men. All I saw were some beetles and the neatly raked earth. On the other side of the gate, Rosalie's son Carlo was cutting back hedges of oleander. He tossed me a smile when he saw me and shyly called out hello. He was at the ungainly age where he was still a boy but longed to be a man. He worked in the store on Sundays and was a good student at the Moravian school. Rosalie loved him too much, and Mr. Enrique doted upon him even more, if that was possible, but fortunately nothing bad had happened to him. Rosalie no longer believed that love brought a curse. A cruel nursemaid had been the one to suggest her own milk had drowned her first baby. It was nonsense, she told me. Babies die from fever, not from love. Yet I continued to fear I would be punished for my unquenchable longing for Frederic. I thought of the way God had let the rain fall down upon us on the day the Reverend wouldn't open the door, and how I had defied them both to get what I wanted. I felt a brand of fear I hadn't known as a younger woman, just as Madame Halévy predicted I would. We pay a price for everything. I saw that now. I walked more narrowly and thought more carefully before I acted and spoke. I knew the chaos I had brought upon my children when I refused to give up Frederic. No one had to tell me how selfish I'd been. I sat with Rosalie for the last time. To me, she looked nearly the same as she had on the day I met her in Monsieur Petit's kitchen. I was young then. She gave me a cup of tea and a slice of coconut cake dolloped with cream. But not as young as you were. We had both made a promise to the same ghost, and because of that we'd been bound together by fate. That had been part of my good fortune. Let's not say goodbye, she said to me on my last day in St. Thomas. I agreed it would be best not to. We both knew that I could never thank her enough. She had taught me everything about raising children when I'd become the mother of three so suddenly. Despite the fact she'd been violated and forced into servitude, she couldn't have been kinder to a girl who knew nothing, not even what happened when a husband came into bed. "Didn't your mother tell you anything?" she had asked me each time she discovered how much I had to learn. Whatever I did know had been a lesson from Adele, and then only told to me in whispers to ensure that my mother couldn't overhear. As I was leaving, I noticed that Rosalie had adopted the rose tree my mother hated. She said it was an unnatural plant, not worth the water it needed to survive, with huge pink blooms that called wasps and bees to it. But it had been on the patio of the cottage for so long, Rosalie said. Who was she to let it die? My mother despised it even though it was a gift from my father. Likely she wanted something more. Rosalie shook her head, mystified by all I still had to learn. She didn't like it because it wasn't for her. There was another woman in your house, and she was very pleased with this gift. Mr. Enrique had been taking care of the rose tree ever since your mother disposed of it. I didn't ask any questions, and she didn't offer any answers, but we understood each other all the same. We both had come to believe that Adele was more to my father than most of us had known, except perhaps for my mother. As a girl, I had known the world by way of my own angry heart and hadn't paid attention to issues that didn't concern me. Children were hushed and dismissed, sent to their rooms. So much the better, I'd always thought. I was immersed in my own troubles, plotting my escape. But now my memory added all I'd failed to see. The intrigue of a closed door. Three petals of a fragrant rose burning in a dish in the kitchen. A woman crying. The garden gate closing so softly I hadn't been sure whether or not I'd heard it. The redness of my father's eyes when he came to tell me I was to be wed. The way my mother would study Justine as if looking for features she might recognize. I left Rosalie before either of us could cry. I had spent more time in her company than in anyone else's, and she in mine. I was fierce with other people, as harsh as my own mother on some occasions, but never with Rosalie. She had managed to see through me. She told me things other people would have been afraid to say to my face, but she never told me I was wrong to get into the bed of the young man from France. Now, as we said our goodbyes, she kissed me 3 times, then a 4th time for luck. She reminded me of her best piece of advice and suggested I would do well to listen to her. Love more, not less. It was the end of the season for the flamboyant trees, the glorious month of September. I wouldn't see flowers such as these again, not unless I traveled to Madagascar. The sailors from the country had gone to great trouble to bring the original specimens across the ocean, wrapping the roots in burlap, sharing their own precious drinking water, all for a blessing on their journey. There were only a few blooms left, but I gathered enough to leave an armful of flowers on Madame Petite's grave and on the grave of the Reverend's first wife, for my marriage to Frederic had been recognized, and my children's names had been written down in the Book of Life, and I believed I owed this to her ghost. I left white stones in remembrance of my sons, and my parents, and of Isaac. He'd known I'd never loved him, but that hadn't mattered at the time. We had an agreement, and we both kept to it. When I left, leaves drifted into my hair. Usually I kept them out of respect to the spirits, but on this occasion I shook my head, letting them scatter. They came from the bay tree and were spicy with scent. Some people folded them in with their belongings when they packed for a journey, but I left them where they'd fallen. Justine and I set off on a windy day when the sea was green. My husband held me for as long as he could until the captain called, insisting it was time for us to leave. There was the tide to think of and seas that grew rougher with each day that was further from summer. Justine and I both wore black, as if in mourning for the lives we'd once led and the people we would no longer be. We noticed a pelican swooping after our ship and left fish from our dinner on the railings. We collected feathers to keep on our bureaus, but when we were far out to sea, a chill met us and the pelican disappeared. We tossed out crusts of bread and mussels taken from their shells, but there were no birds here, so far from land, only the blue light of the open sea. We sailed northward, and soon the ocean turned dark. There were nights a scrim of ice formed on the bow of the boat. We slipped on black gloves and woolen cloaks and drank hot tea with tiny slices of lemon. There was a bushel of lemons and 2 barrels of limes, and out at sea they were highly prized. We were the only passengers who braved the cold on deck as twilight spread across the horizon. Our cabins were drafty and smelled of mold, and we preferred to stay where we could gaze at the stars, as we had on the nights when the turtles rose from the sea. We'd planned to be on a ship such as this one since we were 10 years old. It seemed no time had passed since then, yet we were about to turn 60. We looked in mirrors and didn't recognize ourselves. We laughed and pointed and cried out, "Who are these old ladies?" When the waves became so high the deck was slippery to walk upon, water sloshed below into our quarters. We needed to hold on to ropes simply to cross to the dining room. We ignored the bad weather as best we could and celebrated our birthdays together as we always had. We ate shrimp with lime juice and drank white wine while the waves crashed against the hull of the ship. People asked if we were sisters, twins born on the same day. We were amused and said of course not. But I had always wondered about how alike we looked, and now I realized other people could see it as well. I had a twinge of feeling for my mother. If Justine had indeed been my father's daughter, surely Madame Palmier must have known. No wonder she despised the rose tree and Adele and me, for my father preferred us all to her. There was no one left to tell us the truth, so Justine and I shrugged off such questions. We toasted each other, then cut our birthday cake in even halves and ate every crumb. It didn't matter what had happened on St. Thomas in the past. All that hurt and love was long ago. It was in the time of the turtles, and that time was over. All along the harbor there were lights, and the turtles went elsewhere to lay their eggs. They would not return, just as Justine and I both knew we were never going back. That was when we stopped wearing black. Decades had passed since Liddy had been abducted. I couldn't understand how time could pass so slowly when we were young and fly so quickly now. Justine worried that after so long apart, she and Liddy wouldn't recognize each other. She said she was now ugly and perhaps she should wear a veil so as not to frighten her daughter and grandchildren. That was nonsense, and I said so. If we had been sisters, she would have been the pretty one. I would have been the one who was too smart for her own good and too bossy. Justine was still beautiful. Even on the ship, men had glanced at her and could not look away. She flushed but had no interest. She might have married a dozen times during the past years. Certainly there had been men who did their best to win her over, several of whom had come to me and begged me to plead their cases. Some were local men who wished to marry her. Two were men of my faith who came to me secretly, certain I would favor them considering my own struggles with the congregation. One was a European businessman who insisted he would do anything to win Justine. He was particularly ardent and had already planned her future with him. They would go back to Denmark, where no one would know her mother was a slave, and she would live as a wealthy burgher's wife. Justine had laughed when I told her his plan. She said she would rather know who her mother was than who he was. So he gave up and went back to Denmark without her. She turned down all of her suitors without regret. Her plan was always to be on this ship, going to Paris. One night, I was awakened by a sound I didn't recognize. Then I realized it had begun to rain. We were in the middle of the ocean, between worlds. It was a light rain that fell in endless silver streams, so different from the torrential storms we had on the island. From that time on, it didn't stop. There was so much rain that the green seed of bitterness I'd always carried inside me bloomed into a flower. It wasn't some terrible and monstrous plant, even though it had been sown from the sorrow of my mother's disdain for me. It wasn't at all what I expected. A white flower with pale green edges. I thought it was a moon flower, a parting gift from the original people on our island, who had wanted nothing more than to bring light wherever they walked. Aboard the ship, my childhood came back to me as it had in Rosalie's cottage. What had been murky was now clear as daylight. I'd come to remember nights my mother waited for my father when he didn't come home. She would be in the parlor and I would hear her crying. I wondered where he was on those nights. At that age, I still believed in werewolves and feared he would be eaten alive. I remembered confiding in Adele, telling her I didn't think my father cared for my mother. She whispered back that you couldn't force someone to love you. Either he did or he didn't, and no spell or trick or prayer could make it so. She ran her fingers through my hair as she spoke. I loved the way her voice sounded. I'd held on to the small hope that somehow I could exchange mothers with Justine. But when, after a disagreement with my mother, I confided in my father that I wished I could be Adele's daughter, he slapped me. It was the only time he did so. "Never say that again," he told me. As we neared France, I wondered if I would miss hearing the sea beneath me as I slept. Sometimes the waves were so big the ship rocked back and forth and I had to hold on to the bedpost or be shaken onto the floor. I knew there were turtles below us, perhaps even the woman in the story who had chosen their way of life over ours. I missed my husband most at night. We often shared our dreams as well as our waking life. Later, when we reunited, we discovered that during separation we had dreamed of each other. There he would be, standing on a cobblestone lane beside the Seine. There I was, casting off my black cape, wearing a white linen slip. We sat entwined on a green bench. "Don't wake up," he would say. When I did, I would know he'd been dreaming of me. We arrived in Marseille, where we spent a few days at our hotel on a bluff overlooking the cold Atlantic. We laughed at our sea legs and were greedy for fresh fruit and vegetables. We slept almost till noontime. Justine had caught a chill on the ship and now came down with a cough. We booked an extra day at our hotel so that a local doctor could visit. He assured us that if Justine drank hot tea with honey, we could continue on to Paris. We took a train to the gleaming Gare de Lyon station, which had only just opened. My heart was pounding to have finally reached the destination I'd yearned for. It was the last few days of the Universal Exposition, a grand event attended by over 5 million people since its opening in May in the Jardin des Champs-Élysées. Paris was mad with joy. Crowds were everywhere, and we were quite stunned when we arrived in the station. Exiting the train was much like stepping into a storm that swirled in circles. I closed my eyes and listened to the crush around us. It was like listening to the sea. At heart, we were still two girls from an island where everyone knew everyone else. This city was a gorgeous madhouse. Justine took my hand and pulled me along. My eyes were wide. I was taking it in. The work of Haussmann, who had been commissioned by Napoleon III to reconstruct and reorder the parks and avenues, made the city a mystery, replacing my father's maps with a new and gorgeous vision. Everything I'd imagined was redesigned and brand new. The Rue de Rivoli completed, and a new square, Place Saint-Germain-l'Auxerrois, now faced the colonnade of the Louvre, as magnificent a building as there was in all the world. I was as awake as I'd ever been. I was also inside the dream I'd been dreaming my whole life long. How bright it was. How burning. I was a moth in a shabby dress, though I wore my finery. I wanted to be closer to it all, enveloped in the light. A beautiful woman was approaching. She wore a fur-trimmed coat over a blue silk dress. When she threw up her arms to wave, I understood this was the same girl who had sat on the porch of the house built on stilts, the child who'd been lost for a lifetime. I had given my luck to Justine and was glad to have done so. She ran to embrace her daughter, who was soon enough joined by three lovely girls. A young boy lagged behind his mother, too shy to say hello. This was Leo, born in August and named for that month's constellation of the lion in the sky. Lydie's husband, a Monsieur Cohen, had arranged a carriage for us. Lydia came to embrace me and welcome me to Paris as well. "So you're Camille's mother. We would never all be together right now if it weren't for him. He has such integrity." We went first to the Cohen's apartment on the Ile de la Cité. It had begun to rain again, and we rushed into the building to avoid the showers, making our way along a stone staircase with a mahogany banister. There was the echo of our footfalls. The three girls laughed and raced up ahead of us. We would have tea, Lydie declared. Then she would have her husband take me to the lodging Frederic had leased, where my ailing daughter Delphine was already staying. The Cohen's apartment was small but beautifully appointed, with salmon-colored divans and crystal gas lamps, belongings, I later learned, that were the only household goods Monsieur Cohen had been allowed to take from the house his family owned. They had been disavowed by the family and the community, as Frederic and I had once been. Beyond the issue of her African heritage, Lydia was not considered a member of our faith because her true mother had not been Jewish. The Cohens had donned black armbands, and the rabbi had read the morning prayers just as if Henri had died, for to his family he had. Should they happen to pass him in the street, he would be nothing more than a ghost to his own mother, and his daughters would be strangers, though they had been cherished as babies and adored as young children. Monsieur Cohen had been employed in another bank owned by a French company. He was not in a manager's position anymore. He did not discuss his family, nor did he see them when they suggested they meet without Lydia. I tried not to impinge on Lydia and Justine's conversation, although I couldn't help but overhear bits and pieces. From a window I saw Notre Dame. I heard bells and the sound of water running in the streets. At last my dream had come to pass. It was almost too much for me, the sheer reality of this new life. I grew dizzy and leaned against the window pane flecked with rain. Justine came to stand beside me. "They want me to stay here with them." "Are you sure you'll be comfortable?" Lydia overheard and called out, "Of course you'll stay here. The girls are moving into one room, and Mama will have the room with the view of the river." I went to see Justine's room. Perhaps I hoped it would not be good enough and I would then encourage her to stay with me. "She has to approve," Justine told her daughter, nodding toward me. "She's always been the bossy one." True enough, but even I had nothing to complain about. Although quite small, the chamber was lovely, with moss-green silk wallpaper flocked with gold and creamy decorative woodwork. There was a high bed with many pillows in shades of jade and scarlet, and a bureau on which there was a vase of pale pink peonies, clearly placed there to welcome Justine. Iron grillwork covered the lower half of the window, and there were damask drapes in an apricot color. The Seine was right outside. I peered out at the still green water and the rain falling down. I knew this was where Justine wanted to be. "I approve," I said. I left before Lydia opened her present, the moon dress Justine had sewn. She had taken my mother's necklace apart and tacked the pearls to the bodice. She'd used silk thread from China and dyes made of lavender and guava berries. That exchange was private, between mother and daughter. Justine and I kissed each other in farewell. We had done what we'd set out to do, and we were both exhausted. Then Monsieur Cohen took me to what would now be my home. "Don't worry about your friend," he said to me. "She was loved before she came to Paris, and will be even more loved now that she is here." I thanked him for his kind help. He and I were kindred spirits, after all, willing to do anything for love. Our apartment in Passy on the Rue de la Pompe was too large for us, but there was no time to look for another. Delphine was extremely ill, and I hadn't realized how serious her condition was. She was one of the twins, as we called them, for she and Emma had been born so close together they formed their own society. Delphine had been Frederic's favorite, a flower, he called her, and he gave in to her whims whenever she wanted dogs or tamed birds. "She has a kind heart," he always said to me, "like yours." I smiled when he spoke these words, knowing full well he was likely the only person on earth who thought I had a heart at all. I hired a nurse immediately, but Delphine did not improve. I watched her sleep in a fever, fading more each day. Perhaps I hadn't been a good enough mother to my daughters. We had company. My niece and her five children came for weekends to cheer us up, and Lydia was often a guest, but the apartment was too quiet, even with visitors. I got lost in the rooms. The kitchen was vast, and my bedroom was the largest I'd ever seen. With a bed so high, I was afraid I would fall off in the middle of the night without Frederic to hold on to. I did not walk in the park or shop on the Rue de Rivoli. Haussmann's rebuilding had demolished entire neighborhoods. I did not recognize the city, for it was brand new, and when I did venture out, I often found myself lost. When Justine came to call, we had green tea and studied the leaves in our cups to see what our children's futures might be. I had the best doctors come, and still Delphine coughed up blood. I thought about the herb man in the countryside and the curse he had given me. None of the ingredients could be found in Paris, not even in the African markets in Montmartre, where I went with Lydia on Saturdays to search the stalls. We found nothing from our island, no flowers, no herbs. At night I heard bird songs I didn't recognize. I wrapped a blanket around my shoulders and gazed out the tall, leaded windows while Delphine slept uneasily. In bad weather it was not possible to get warm here in Paris. Frederic had told me that. He'd said he'd always worn socks to bed. He was never warm until he came to St. Thomas. Now it was my turn to know the chill of this city. I could feel my blood growing colder and thinner, a pale ribbon of red. The vines outside had lost their leaves and only twisted gray stalks were left. Being inside of a dream was beautiful and sad. I liked to hear about Justine's life, her mischievous grandson Leo, who was growing taller each day. She recounted her days spent with her granddaughters, whom she brought to dance classes, and then to have hot chocolate at a sweet shop across from the Tuileries. They too would soon be women, on to their own lives. Best of all, Justine said, were the evenings she spent with Lydia, for after all these years apart, they simply couldn't stop talking. On Sundays, the entire family went to the Bois de Boulogne, the huge park Monsieur Haussmann, soon to be titled Baron, had constructed, where it was said there were werewolves at night, just as there had been in Charlotte Amalia, when the old corrupt families came out of their houses to drink blood for pleasure. Justine's grandchildren begged for stories about our island, as we had longed to hear about Paris. Sometimes she brought them to my house and they sat on the carpet enthralled while I read to them from my notebooks. They thought St. Thomas was a fairyland and asked if I could collect magic and call spirits to me as their grand-mère said I could. "That was long ago," I told them. in a place where such things were possible. I left Delphine while she slept in the late afternoon so I could go out walking. I tried to follow the routes of the maps in my father's library, but Monsieur Haussmann had torn up the old twisted streets from the time of Perrault's fairy tales and begun to replace them with broad, elegant avenues and plazas. I became accustomed to the new Paris and found my way. I often passed the same old lady in the nearby park who sat with a black pug dog on her lap. The clouds were different here, so high up in the sky. I walked along the gravel paths in the park, waiting for the light to turn orange as the sun began to set. I went along the river, for although some people said it wasn't safe, I was drawn to the water. I imagined the wharves and docks I had known, the waterfall with the blue fish. Sometimes I cried and my tears fell into the river. I did not wish to be old or fierce. I wanted to be a woman who took a young man into her bed after she had drawn the shades and locked the door. As the dusk settled, I walked back to the apartment, stopping to buy bunches of blue flowers at the shop on the corner, where the owner and I knew each other well enough to nod a greeting. Each flower had 1,000 petals. They didn't grow in our country, but here they were everywhere, and as the weather grew colder, they turned from blue to pink and then to scarlet. I was a little less lonely when I employed several servants, 2 to clean and see to the laundry, and 2 to work in the kitchen, an old woman named Clara, and her assistant Julie, a girl not more than 20, who had recently arrived from the countryside of Burgundy near Dijon. I heard the girl, Julie, tell the other maid that she had never seen a Jew before, but I didn't hold this against her. She had spent her life on a farm, and had lived simply, and had likely not seen many things in this world. The housemaids filled up the rooms with their lively conversation, and with the delicious scent of their cooking. One night, Julie made a chicken stuffed with chestnuts that was perhaps the most delicious dish I'd ever tasted. I remembered reading recipes to Justine so many years ago, and how hungry we were for all the food we never tasted. As it turned out, the assistant cook was more talented than the cook in charge. She made an exceptional apple tartine and applesauce that was extraordinary. Her family had an orchard beside their house, and she had told me that she believed apples to be a gift from God. Her God, I did not say out loud, not ours. The God that chased our people into hiding from one country to another, in the case of my husband's family, for nearly 300 years. I thought of the tree we had left behind in St. Thomas, the one my father had loved and Mr. Enrique now cared for, with its twisted bark and bitter fruit, our namesake. I wondered if I had cursed myself for not bringing it with us to France. Perhaps it was fate that out of all the girls I might have hired, I chose the one who could bring me apples from Dijon. My husband and son arrived in late November in time to be with Delphine before her death. I had now lost 3 children. The Jewish cemetery was in Passy, where the earth was cold and hard. There were no leaves falling from the trees, no birds singing, no red flowers, only ice on the ground. We needed to hire a rabbi and pay for mourners, for we hadn't enough family. There had been some disagreement over the fact that Frederic had left the business in Mr. Enrique's hands, and we needed 10 men to say the prayers for the dead. Afterward, the only people who came to the funeral supper were Justine and Lydia and her family. The very next day, I had the maids burn my daughter's linens and make up the room for my son. Justine returned and we locked the door of Delphine's chamber and burned herbs in an earthenware dish, then threw open all the windows and let the spirit of my quiet, pretty daughter go. There was a horse chestnut tree just outside, leafless now, but home enough if Delphine's ghost wished to stay. The apartment was so big there was no reason for Camille not to live with us indefinitely. Yet he looked displeased when Frederic told him we would pay for his studies and that Delphine's room was to be his. He was now in his mid-20s, a grown man who didn't wish to do as he was told. Perhaps he believed artists must live in an alleyway or in a canvas tent in the Bois de Boulogne. He stayed in our lodgings but kept to himself. I had dinner served every evening at 7, but he never joined us. He took his meals in cafes and came home long after we were in bed. I suppose he had contempt for us and thought of us as shopkeepers. Sometimes he was covered with paint and the parlor maid had to scrub the hallway carpets after his boots left tracks of pale vermilion and violet. He'd begun to work as Anton Melby's assistant. This painter was the brother of the tall red demon I had chased out of St. Thomas. I'd had to pay good money to the constables in order to do so, but in the end it hadn't mattered. My son had followed the demon to Venezuela despite my wishes. He did as he pleased then and now. One evening I came home from the Coens to hear my husband and son arguing. I'd never heard a conversation as heated and belligerent between the two. My husband was defending me in response to my son calling me a cold and heartless woman. I was in the front hall, well out of sight, still wearing my cape and gloves, unsure what to do next, when the young maid from the countryside brought some tea and cake into the parlor where the argument was taking place. She walked right in as if this was her home, not mine. "So kind of you," my husband said. I could tell from his tone that he was embarrassed to have a servant observe such a private encounter.
"You needn't serve us,"
my son said as the maid began to pour the tea. "Of course I must," she assured him, "and you must have large slices of cake." I think it was an apple cake, made with fruit from her family's orchard that she'd brought back from a visit. I'd learned that her people were Catholic farmers who had a deep attachment to their land. Before coming to Passy, this girl had worked on the family farm and in their vineyards. She knew how to handle most household situations, and she clearly knew how to handle angry men. When the kitchen had flooded during a rainstorm, she'd mopped up the water, then had taken it upon herself to fix the ceiling with plaster and glue. I had stumbled upon her when she was in the midst of her repairs. White dust fell as she worked away. She looked as if she were standing in a snowstorm. "It's winter," she called out cheerfully. And indeed I had felt something along my spine at that very moment. I suppose I had a sense of what was to come even then. Julie was 8 years younger than my son, but she seemed the more mature of the two. She had capable hands and a direct gaze. I could not fault her for her work. And her apple cake was excellent, as was her timing. She had ended the disagreement between father and son. When my son looked up to thank her, I could see that he was drawn in. He had passed her by a dozen times, but now he clearly saw her in a different light. Perhaps he saw what I did at the moment I felt the chill of recognition, the snow, the peace, the purity. She wore a black dress and a white cap. Her eyes were haint blue. She was not pretty, but she was capable and serene. When I gazed at my son, I was reminded of Frederic's expression when he first saw me. He had seemed like a fish in a net, desperate for air, yet not wishing for any escape. This was the way such things happened, whether by accident or preordained, whether you wished for it or despaired over it, you could not look away. After that first encounter, Camille began to search out my maid. It took time, but soon enough he was sitting with her while she cooked dinner, as he had long ago gone to Madame Halevy's kitchen, drawn there as if it were the only place on earth worth visiting. He still wore the old witch's ring, a single gold band. Once I spied him twisting it while he spoke to Julie. I caught sight of the glint of gold before I saw him whispering to my kitchen maid in the corridor, his hand on her waist. I did what I could to keep them apart. Julie came to me once when I was reading. "Did you want something?" I asked. We looked at each other, and I knew exactly what she wanted. "I'm sorry if I disturbed you," she said.
"Well, you have," I said.
If she had stayed at home, surely she would have married some farm worker who could neither read nor write. But she had come here and she had seen Paris, and now my son had changed the way she looked at the world. But that did not change the way the world was. I knew that from experience. I would not let her ruin his life. I gave Julie days off when I knew that my son would be home from the studio, but he was defiant.
"Your plans won't work," he said, "and you needn't be rude to her."
"If she wanted to see you, she'd be here," I said, wishing to plant a seed of doubt in his mind. I did not want to lose him to the world outside ours, and so perhaps I was rude, but it didn't matter. When he found Julie gone, he took the train to Burgundy and set up his easel in the snow. I came to believe that Madame Halevy had cursed me, so that I would know and understand the pain of her loss. None of the servants told me when they found Julie sitting in my son's lap in the pantry, her arms entwined around his neck. Why would they be loyal to me? I was a demanding old woman who liked my coffee hot and my husband's clothes pressed carefully. They were young and in love. I suspected that Julie smelled of apples, for I found several cores in her apron one day. The black seeds fell onto the carpet and I could not find them, even when I got onto my hands and knees to search. That was when I knew. I should never have hired her. 1863. As Jacob waited 7 years for Rachel, my son waited 7 years for our kitchen maid. At first I argued with him, but my entreaties had no effect. I was honest with him, as I believe a mother should be. We sat in my chamber where I had hung the painting of Justine and the tiny painting of the cathedral. He was painting more all the time, but I adored these two early works. That did not mean I would give in to my son, though he was now considered a fine artist by many of his peers, not that their respect paid his bills. "There is nothing you can say against her that will change my mind," Camille said. His hands were rough, his clothes unwashed, but he had gracious manners, likely inherited from his father who had never lost his French elegance. "She's uneducated," I said.
"As you were," he shot back at me.
"I was my father's student," I informed him.
"She'll be mine," Camille said.
He crossed his long legs. He looked out of place in our chamber. His clothes were paint-smeared, but I dared not reprimand him for this. "Our people have struggled in order to survive. That is why we band together and why it is a sin to marry outside our faith." He laughed then and shook his head.
"You're not serious. Do you dare to tell me about the rules of marriage? Was I not the one who went to the Moravian school, who had no bar mitzvah, who was an outcast from my own people, all because of you? You did as you pleased.
But your father was of our faith. In the eyes of God, we did the right thing." Camille stood then, sick of arguing and sick at heart.
"You loved him, and that was that. So please don't tell me to do otherwise." There was the dull thud of recognition when I realized how pig-headed my son was. Tell him no, and he was bound to do what was forbidden. He had never viewed the world the way others did, and that was more true now than ever. We continued to support him, paying the rent for a studio, and then when he moved out of our apartment, also for lodgings in the far side of the city. I felt the old bitterness inside me twisting through my heart. The distance between a mother and a child that I now knew from both sides. When I passed by the mirror in the corridor, I sometimes thought it was my mother's image I spied, not mine. This was her revenge. Everything I had done to her, my son now did to me. We had made the right decision to leave St. Thomas, for the war between the states was raging. South Carolina, where much of the trade had been the first state to secede after Lincoln was elected and no ships were safe. The Emancipation Proclamation declared that as of January 1, 1863, all slaves would be freed. But the bloody business of freedom took a toll, as it had on our islands. We read about the horrors and were grateful to be in Paris, where the only war was in our family. Camille came and asked for our approval to marry my maid, admitting that Julie had become pregnant. We denounced their union, for we were reminded of ourselves and we did not wish the same troubles on our son that we had experienced. Then the baby was lost. After that I couldn't sleep. I couldn't look at myself in the mirror. Who would I find there? I wondered if every girl grew up to be a stranger to herself. What would I have thought of myself if I could go back and meet face to face with the headstrong woman I once was, pounding on the reverend's door, eyes shining, convinced that love was the only thing that mattered? Camille still wished to marry Julie, even though she was Catholic and uneducated, a farm girl who knew when an apple was ripe, but had never met a Jew before her employment in our home. To marry outside our faith was unacceptable. I wondered if my mother's ghost was whispering in my son's ear, urging him to defy me just to be vindictive,
or if he was still under the influence of that witch, Madame Halevy, who first turned him against me. He did not believe in our faith, or our God, or in any God, it seemed. He had declared that his only faith was in nature, a leaf, a flower, a woman with blue eyes whose soul was as quiet as snow. He was an anarchist and a leader of his fellow painters, all outsiders, who were not wed to the old-fashioned forms of realism, all of whom looked up to him. When I saw him now, his coat flaring out behind him, his tall, awkward form lurching down the cobbled streets, he seemed like an angel who had lost his way and was plummeting into the darkness. At last I understood what my mother had told me. I would only understand her grief when my child caused me my own. Our son was too much of a rebel to work within any academy, and soon left his position with Melby. He studied with the master landscape painter Corot, with whom he journeyed out of Paris, declaring that the countryside was an antidote to all that poisoned our society. He grew more radical, faithful to the best interests of the working man. He was already an outcast among the establishment and had been rejected from the exhibition by the Salon. The established painters did not care for his work or his politics. But the Emperor Napoleon III had surprised everyone by setting up an alternative gallery, the Salon des Refusés, for new artists such as Monet and Cézanne, and Manet and the American painter Whistler, and of course, Pizarro. Respected and loved by this group of radical artists. I did not understand my son as a man, but I had come to understand there was a vision other than the one we had known. After living with his art in my own chamber, I saw there was more than mere mimicry, and that art was a world unto itself, with its own symbols and language. A leaf seen in certain light might be gray or violet, as well as purple, and a latticework of twigs might easily turn red as the sky paled above the city. One afternoon, I discovered a painting left in our vestibule. I saw the wet footprints of oversized shoes on the black and white tiles. The portrait was of a woman beneath a flowering fruit tree, a basket of apples beside her. This was a gift to me, an entreaty to accept his choice. Had I not wanted the very same thing, enough to stand in the rain, to defy everyone and everything, to love whom I wished to rather than whom I was told I must? I felt the sting of pride. Even I could tell it was a great work of art. Of course I recognized the model as Julie. I brought the painting inside and stored it in the wardrobe behind the winter coats. Their son was born on February 20th. I did not visit the new baby, born without benefit of marriage. On my behalf, Justine and Lydia brought presents to the countryside where the couple was now residing. We had shopped together for blankets, quilts, baby sweaters, and breeches. On the evening when these gifts were delivered, Frederic and I went to sit in a café. We knew it was wrong not to be with our son and grandson, and yet here we were. Though it was chilly, we found a table outside and ordered hot tea and rum. Since leaving St. Thomas, I had acquired a taste not only for rum but for molasses, which I spooned onto my toast in the morning. I'd begun to want the things I had thought little of when I was young. Sometimes I longed for the brilliant sunlight I had always despised. It was already dusk, and Lydia and Justine were probably on the train home. My new kitchen maid had likely made a wonderful dinner, perhaps a savory chicken stuffed with chestnuts. The air was silver and the evening was made bright by the ice on the ground and a light falling snow. We did not hurry despite the weather. I didn't complain, though my face smarted with the cold. My husband wore a felt hat and the black coat that had been his first purchase upon arriving home in France. I could hear the wood pigeons in the plane trees nearby fluttering from branch to branch, trying to keep warm. I looked up and saw three birds perched above us. I knew that sorrow came in threes, and I feared that number. I told my husband we should leave for home, but he held on to my hand. When I'd first looked out the window on the day he arrived, I had expected to be confronted with an enemy. Instead, I saw his heart beneath his shirt. I heard it beating. "Perhaps we should accept the situation," he said as we walked home through the dark. "The world is changing." "Not fast enough," I said. "Then let us be among those who hope that the future would be less cruel than the past. That night I tried on the earrings my mother had brought to St. Thomas in the hem of her skirt. I could barely see my reflection in the cold hallway. At that moment, I was so flooded with doubt I might have agreed with those who thought I was a witch with the power to commit the foulest of deeds. I thought Frederic was already in bed, but he saw me peering into the silvered mirror. He came to circle his arms around me, and in the dark, he told me that he knew the truth about me as no one else ever would. The woman who had saved his life with a kiss. That year, Lydia's daughter Leah was to wed a doctor from Senegal, a man named Joseph Haiti, whom she had met through my own doctor, Dr. Paul Gachet, for both doctors' practices included natural elements along with traditional cures. Leah and Dr. Haiti were already living together in an apartment in Montmartre. I thought there might be a scandal, for although Leah was of mixed race, she was considered European by anyone who saw her because of her pale skin and gray eyes. But Montmartre was an accepting place, and no one paid attention to the actions of this couple. Clearly, Paris wasn't bound by the rules of St. Thomas. The Cohens had already been shunned by their family, none of whom attended the wedding. I brought the bride and groom a gift of crystal glasses along with a bottle of rum from our island. Dr. Haiti had been treating Frederic, who had fallen ill with a sort of wasting disease. For several months, my husband had difficulty eating, and the doctor often came to our apartment. He recommended no alcohol, no dairy, and no wheat. Still, there had been little improvement. Dr. Haiti checked in on him at the wedding reception as Frederic sat at the table, drinking hot tea with lemon. "Does he complain about pain?" the doctor asked when he came to greet me. "Never," I said. "Well then, that is the sort of man he is," the doctor said with clear appreciation of my husband. I realized then he meant the pain was excruciating, and that another man would not have been able to do any more than lie in bed. Dr. Haiti spoke to me about looking for a studio to rent for Leah, for she was an accomplished watercolorist. I had two of her paintings in my bedchamber, lovely images of the new broad avenues in the city. Perhaps the doctor imagined I had insights into the art world, for my son was so well known, but the most I could offer was the suggestion that she use one of the rooms in my large apartment. "Oh, I think she wants her very own place," the doctor said, though he thanked me for the invitation. He then asked me about St. Thomas, a place he'd always wanted to visit, for he and Leah planned to travel after their marriage. The doctor was a tall, handsome man, very dark, with liquid eyes. In the St. Thomas of my childhood, he and I would have never been sitting at the same table. In the United States, he would be a soldier or a slave, not a highly regarded doctor marrying my dear friend's daughter. I recommended Malta as a possible destination, or perhaps the south of France. There was music playing, and Leah signaled for her new husband to join her on the dance floor. "If you'll pardon me," he excused himself graciously, "there is my beautiful wife." She was indeed the most beautiful of the three sisters. Often when I spied her, it was as though I were looking back in time, seeing Justine at that same age. In the marriage hall, the ceiling had been strung with dozens of lanterns that floated like fireflies. At every table, there were vases of delphiniums and lilies and hyacinth and lilacs, all flowers we hadn't known on our island. I had often gone through botanical books in my father's library and cut out the illustrations of flowers that grew in France so I might paste them in my journal. They were far more beautiful than I had imagined. I took a hyacinth to carry in my cloak. I sat beside my old friend in her place of honor at the marriage table. "You're not worried anymore?" I'd asked her, for we had talked at length about the consequences of Leah marrying a man from Senegal. "It will do me no good to worry," Justine said. "Perhaps we should both be thankful that anyone manages to find love." "Perhaps." I wished not to discuss this issue any further, for I knew my friend's meaning to be that I would do well to reconsider my disapproval of my son's choice. I often thought of my kitchen maid's apple cake, of her tarts that were so perfect, and how when she first came into my house I had felt a chill, as if she brought the future with her, clinging to her clothes. There would be dancing into the early hours, and because we considered ourselves to be too old for such things, we left early. Our carriage took Justine home first, and Frederick waited, a blanket over his knees, while I accompanied my friend into the empty house, helping her to carry several baskets of flowers. The cold, purple air smelled of hyacinths. We went inside, then up to the parlor, where I waited while Justine lit the lamps and saw to the fire. The rooms were chilly, and we kept our cloaks on while the flames took. It had been a glorious wedding, and we were both teary-eyed. I went to the window to check on the carriage. I do not know what made me do this, a surge of worry, perhaps. I could see Frederick in his black wool coat and black hat waiting for me, the plaid blanket warming him against the night air. I loved him too much, beyond all measure, so much that I was willing to ruin both my own life and the lives of my children. It was then, while I gazed at the scene before me, that I saw three crows in the tree outside the window. They were silent, unmoving, as the bats in our garden were long ago, easily mistaken for dark, sinister leaves. I panicked. I let out a cry that didn't sound human. The hyacinth I'd taken from the wedding party fell from beneath my cloak. I knew from Adele what such a sign portended. All sorrows came in threes, and blackbirds meant death. Justine rushed over and threw open the window. She waved her scarf and shouted out curses, and the birds took flight, screaming as they heaved themselves upon the stone rooftops. "It means nothing," she said. "Do you understand me?" I nodded and said goodnight, then hurried down the cold stairs. I didn't argue with her, but I knew she was wrong. The next morning the light was dim, mauve-colored. The city had seemed darker for weeks, as if the war in America had sifted across the water to us. People dressed in black, fretted over the future, stocked their pantries in case war should come to us as well. There were no birds singing. I noticed that first. Frederick awoke and said he was dreaming about rain as he had when he first came to St. Thomas. When I touched his forehead, he was burning up. My husband's illness, the one I thought the herb man had cured, seemed to have returned. He appeared disoriented. When I spoke to him, there was only a flicker of a response. Dr. Haiti came and, after an examination, said my husband's heart and lungs were weak, and that there was a mass of some sort inside his abdomen. Frederick was only 63, but the disease of his youth had come back to haunt him, and a new disease had formed in his gut because he was so run down. The raw planes of his face were shadowed blue, as if he'd been bruised. I saw faint sparks around him in the dark, the spirits of those who had passed on gathering close by, waiting. After all this time, the ghosts had come back to me, unbidden and unwanted. I wept when my husband began to mutter, his words a dark tangle of pain. And then he took a breath and said that he could see the lavender growing in his parents' garden. He laughed, delighted. There were dozens of bees and fields of purple, and he was so young he grinned to think of all that was before him his whole long life. He began to talk to people I didn't recognize, the dead uncles and aunts he'd seen on trips to Bordeaux when he was just a boy. "May I have some water?" he asked me in a sweet voice. He winced when he attempted to sit up, though there were three pillows beneath him. I felt him slipping away to a world beyond my grasp. I knew that at the end of their lives, many people went backward, searching for the moment when they first glimpsed the light of our world. I got into bed beside Frederick. The doctor had been and gone. My husband was too weak to lift his head. Still, I trusted the soothing tea that Dr. Gachet and Dr. Haiti recommended to fortify his spirit and his strength. Yet he grew weaker. One night he didn't know me. He called me Mademoiselle and said he was lost. I sent for Dr. Haiti in the middle of the night and he came right away, even though the weather was dreadful. The doctor clapped the snow from his coat in the hallway. I greeted him and took his scarf and gloves. "Terrible night," he said. He then asked me to boil water. "For what?" I asked, concerned. I could not imagine Frederick would have the strength for any sort of surgery if that was what was being proposed. "For tea," he told me. He handed me a packet that looked familiar, reddish peels of tree bark and some spices and herbs. I thought it might be the cure the herb man had given me years ago when Justine and I saved Frederic's life. I had forgotten my shoes, and the kitchen floor was freezing.